Stay with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sulis. Interested in learning new skills online at a pace that suits you? Visit ecollege.ie to apply for one of our free online courses.
Now, though, it's time for your questions on parenting, and clinical child psychologist Dr. David Coleman joins me on the line now. And you can still send your questions in for David. 51551 is the text number, or email todaycb@rte.ie. David, good morning to you.
Good morning, Claire. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Let's start with a question about teenage discos. Where better to start? So this listener wants to know what your stance is on teenage discos that start in first year. For this reason, I would really prefer if my son and daughter, who are in the process of starting secondary school, didn't attend these until junior cert or later, when they're more mature for these environments. This parent says, I don't agree with the clothes girls wear to these discos, in inverted commas, and how the kissing experiments start between boys and girls, which are filmed on mobile phones. I think my children are too young for all of this complicated behaviour. It's giving them a skewed idea of how relationships between girls and boys should be. They're very sporty children with lots of friends, and I feel they will have enough going on with sports and new school subjects without adding relationships this early in their young lives. Would David agree with putting a rule like this in place with my children? I'm concerned it might exclude them, as so many out of their friend groups will be attending these. I'm also concerned it will leave them less able to cope when they do eventually attend discos and other events at 15 or 16 years of age. That's from a worried mother. So what do you think, David? Do you allow them to go to the discos at 12 or 13, or make them wait until they're a little bit older?
Yeah, it's a difficult conundrum, I think. It's one of those dilemmas that every parent is going to have to face at some stage. And certainly my view on it has changed over the years. I think before my own children kind of reached that age of kind of 12, 13, 14, I think I was much clearer that, oh, no, absolutely, teenage disco is a bad thing. You know, keep them away from them until they're much older. But as my own kids approach the age and doing a lot more reading, talking to other colleagues, I think I've come to the conclusion that actually the kind of first year discos are probably the safest way to let your children begin to experience the whole kind of disco thing. It's also a time when they're much more open, usually, to talking with you about what's going on in their lives. They're much more open to perhaps your guidance and you know, your value system in terms of what you think is okay and not okay. And so the very issues that you know, that mum is concerned about, you know, the kind of what girls in particular are going to be wearing perhaps to those discos, and you know, elements of kind of sexual behavior that might even be starting at those discos. Those are all things I think that you can talk about, and you can talk about your values in relation to those two things. And I think, you know, your children are much more likely to be open to hearing what you have to say if you do prevent them going to those kinds of discos and insist that they wait until they're older. The kind of behavior that's happening at the older discos is probably going to be a lot more shocking and a lot more difficult for them to kind of make sense of if they haven't grown up, if you like, in the environment of attending discos that are kind of for their age group. So yeah, it is a bit of a conundrum, but I think on balance, I would suggest to parents, look, you know, let them go to the teenage discos when they hit first year, if it's a first year disco, because they tend to be much better supervised in most situations. So whether it's run by, you know, various different sports clubs usually run those, they're usually based in those kind of sports clubs in the as opposed to being at dedicated venues, mm-hmm. for you know, like nightclub venues that are kind of running then teenage discos, all of which I think just think makes it a safer environment for kids to begin to experiment and come to understand what the discos might be and you know, experience some of those challenges for themselves, because it's not like every child going to those discos is going to want to be part of the whole kissing experiments, as that parent suggests. And so if that's happening and your child is finding that difficult, at least they can come and talk to you about it.
Yeah, it's just I just want to draw your attention to one issue highlighted by that mother, and that was the filming on mobile phones of kissing, and she seems to have a particular issue with that. I mean, that might present an opportunity to prepare both boys and girls to talk about consent.
For sure. And, you know, both consent with regard to the actual behavior, the kissing behavior, or any other kind of sexual behavior that might be suggested or proposed or attempted. But also, you're right, the consent with regard to filming. Although I think children and young teenagers, you know, they have a completely different view than most adults with regard to their privacy and their sense of self when it comes to what is or isn't being recorded. And, you know, there are a lot more free with that. And so I think, again, these are things that it's really useful for parents to be able to talk about. And so, again, if the mum, you know, is very clear that that's what will happen at these discos, then absolutely it's an opportunity to talk about it and to talk about what the comparative, you know, are the potential, you know, dangers might be about both the filming and all that kind of stuff.
This next one now is related, but it's a much younger child, a 7-year-old daughter kissed by a slightly older boy. She said she didn't want it to happen and is blaming herself now. And this parent would like to know if you have any tips on how to deal with this, how to build her confidence, her resilience and her sense of self.
Okay, so that's completely different. Slightly older, I wonder how much older, because that might make quite a significant difference. And what was the context? And so I guess, was it a game that the boy was proposing, that the little girl was involved in? So I would say the first thing, rather than worrying too much about talking with her daughter for the start, would be to talk to the parents of this older boy and to really try to be clear exactly what the context was in which this kiss happened, because that will impact, you know, how she then responds to her daughter. I think, you know, if the daughter is clear that she didn't want it to happen and so this is something that happened against her will, then, you know, that's quite significant. I mean, it absolutely speaks to the whole area of consent, and but it also means that, you know, yeah, I mean, any kind of sense of force or you know, that the boy was coercing her in any way, psychologically or physically, to do this, I think is something quite significant and really needs to be addressed, both for that boy but also for her daughter. So I think perhaps this is also a situation where the mum might actually want to talk with someone. Obviously, she's asked me in this context, but it's not necessarily the best context to be talking about this kind of thing. But talk to someone like me in confidence herself, so that she can really talk through the whole issue, because I think her daughter might need quite a bit of support with regard to the behaviour and the clarity that this was not her choice, that this was not her fault, and that this was something that the boy chose to do and over which she had very little power. But, you know, those are all the dynamics that we come to understand in terms of abuse. And so, you know, you really don't want this little girl to grow up with those kinds of dynamics in place for her, where she feels powerless or where she feels that she has no right to say no or no power to say no in the future. So that's quite a significant and perhaps more complicated scenario. And okay. I would, from the mum's point of view, there definitely be looking for further professional advice in terms of how to respond to her daughter.
So you need to get some more help with that.
I think so.
To that parent. Now, a 5-year-old who's not speaking in school. My son is 5. He started school in September. He has selective mutism. His language is English. He loves school but refuses to speak in school to children or teachers. He speaks fluently at home. He volunteers all of the details of his day to me. He chats to his siblings at home and his sister's friends. He's self-aware that he doesn't speak at school and he says he will just nod yes or no. How can I encourage him? What do you suspect is going on there, David?
Nothing too unusual, in as much as, you know, it's not necessarily a communication issue. You know, this is a little boy who can absolutely speak and, you know, has his opinions and is quite happy to share them, is quite happy to interact with everybody in a home environment where he feels very confident, very comfortable, and perhaps very safe. You know, the school, he's there only, well, I would say in life terms, a wet week, but obviously he's there 2 months now. And I think it's just a question for him of really becoming comfortable in that environment and settling into that environment. And I think if the teacher and you know, other kids put very little pressure on him to speak, I think if the teacher can be satisfied that he nods or shakes his head in assent or dissent, and let the teacher, I suppose, you know, let that be okay for the teacher. The mum can talk with the teacher and let the teacher be reassured that, you know, this is not a little boy who's suffering in any other way developmentally. And then it's just about giving it time and allowing him to speak when he's ready to speak. It's, I don't think it's going to be a huge issue in, over time.
So you expect, given what you've been told there, that this is going to resolve itself?
Yeah. Now, you know, selective mutism, the whole point of it is that it is selective, and or elective is the other word that's used, which means that in many ways, the child has an opportunity to choose whether they speak or not. And so this is a little boy who's choosing not to speak in school for whatever reason. Sometimes there can be an element of kind of a power battle for kids. You know, it's the one thing perhaps that they can have some control over whether they choose to speak or not speak. It doesn't sound like that in his case. It sounds a little bit more like it's to do with perhaps a background anxiety or just, you know, a need to settle in and feel comfortable in the school environment and to fully understand all of the social rules that are there. And I think that's a big thing for kids. You know, sometimes they're just that little bit nervous to get involved until they know exactly how things work and how different kinds of statements and interactions that they observe between other children, between the children themselves, or between children and teachers, see how that all works. And then they might feel more confident to chip in themselves.
All right, let's go back to the teenagers now, David. And this is about the HPV vaccine, which is coming up for this girl. And the listener says, my daughter is terrified. She had a panic attack at the doctor's the last time and she couldn't go ahead. She's also very worried about freaking out in front of her peers. So I assume that's if the vaccine is carried out in school. And it's a real issue for many people, isn't it, David? People going for any kind of vaccine jab, a fear of needles. What do you advise?
Yeah, so definitely I think it's worth that mum or dad, whoever's contacted us, going into the school ahead of the HPV vaccine so that her daughter or his daughter isn't called up for the vaccine with other kids, that it's not a situation where she's publicly going to have to refuse to take it, where it might, you know, lead to lots of other questions. And I mean, there are lots of ways that can be explained as well. And so there are many people, in fact, who don't choose to get the HPV vaccine or any other vaccine in a school setting, but rather they choose to do it where they have a little bit more privacy or opportunity to, I suppose, to prepare for the vaccine by going to their GP separately. So I think that's obviously what's going to have to happen in this case, that she's going to have to go back to the doctor. But it sounds like she's going to need a lot of preparation with regard to her fear of needles. And so the most common way that we approach any of that kind of an actual phobia is with what's called graded exposure, where we try to help a young person to feel some level of confidence in terms of regulating their anxiety. So you don't want the anxiety to rise to the point of panic. You want the young person perhaps to experience some anxiety because they're going to be nervous about it, but feel that they can regulate it through some kind of breathing or other relaxation techniques. It's only at that point then that you can begin to introduce the concept of needles, and again, working with that young person to try to give them the confidence that they can still regulate the level of anxiety, even as the feared thing, the needle, becomes more apparent. So I know certainly when I've done it with young people, you know, I've had the end of the hypodermic needles. I've had them here in the office, and so it's in a closed box, and so the young person knows that there's a needle in the box, and so slowly over time they get to see the needle, they see it on the desk, they eventually get to handle the needle themselves, and even press the needle against the skin of their arm and so on. All the time though, we're working to help them, you know, regulate that anxiety, and that's what this girl, I would imagine, is going to need is proper graded exposure intervention, a cognitive behavioral intervention with regard to the phobia of needles, and only then approach the doctor in terms of getting the vaccine.
Okay, so a lot of work to be done before needle goes in the arm.
Yeah.
Now, we're
getting
through them today. Time for another one. This is about a two-year-old who prefers daddy over mammy, and this is from the dad. Hi Claire and David, we have an issue with our two-year-old who significantly favours one parent over the other. She doesn't go to her mother for comfort and only wants daddy to bring her to bed. It's very hurtful to her mum. Dad does almost all of the morning routine. The little girl's in creche 5 days a week. Mum brings her to and from creche, and the evenings then are shared evenly. Have you any advice?
Yeah, I guess the thing about parenting is that it's a shared endeavor as opposed to a competitive endeavor. And even how some of that is phrased, that it's almost like the dad is kind of categorizing, you know, well, this is the bit that I do, this is the bit that our mom does, and this is the bit that we share evenly. You know, the whole thing about parenting is that there will be lots of stages in children's lives where one or other parent is better suited to dealing with the circumstances that are arising for the child. And so it's not about, you know, that each parent needs or deserves, you know, equal access to their children at all times and to be equally involved. And so in many ways, I think, you know, something for the mum needs to happen in terms of her looking at why it is that she feels really hurt that her daughter doesn't particularly want her to help her soothe at bedtime. So what's that in terms of the mum and her own need to be a caregiver and that experience that we have of caregiving? You know, what is it about the dad where he feels that perhaps, you know, he can't maybe talk to his wife about the issue, and they don't sound like they're communicating very well about it. And so what the dad needs to do, I suppose, is, you know, just, and the mum equally, be really patient that this is where their daughter's at. So this is about their daughter's needs, not about the parents' needs. And mm-hmm. and so if the daughter just needs the dad because that just works better for her, well, then that's the way it is yeah. for now.
And that's exactly. That's the key for now, isn't it? Because things change, David. We'll need to leave it there, but David Coleman will be back on the programme in just a couple of weeks' time. So if you have any questions for David between now and then, do drop us an email. And that email address again is todaycb@rte.ie. But I want to end on this today. It's Vicky Phelan, whose death was announced just this morning. And this is Vicky in her appearance on The Late Late Show. And here she's reading a paragraph from her memoir, Overcoming.
My dying wish will be for the women of Ireland that because of what has happened in this past year, maybe my last year on earth, they will be able to trust that their lives are in safe hands, that they will be minded and cared for at their most vulnerable, and that everything will be done to give them the lives they deserve, the time they deserve, with the people they love and who love them and who need them in the world. There will be others who will continue this fight without me when I'm gone, because we are all in this together at the end of the day. We all come from that same place, from a mother's womb. This is everybody's story.
That was the voice of Vicky Phelan. And once again, all of our condolences this morning to her children, Amelia and Dara, her husband, Jim, and of course, her parents, her wider family and her friends. Today's programme was produced by Barbara Feeney, research by Amy Ryan. Our broadcast coordinator was Louise Kerr-Ross. Ruth Kennington was on sound. And now it's over to Ronan Collins.